Welcome to this second plenary session. The speaker for this session is Professor Owen Devereux. He's Professor of Sociology at the University of Limerick, Ireland. He's also the Dean for Research at this university, and he's also adjunct professor, docent in contemporary culture at this university, Jyväskylä. Professor Devereux is also the co-founder of the research clusters Power, Discourse and Society and Popular Music and Popular Culture at his home university. He's an expert on indie music and rock music fandom as well. Among his publications, many of them are books such as Understanding the Media, which has run at least to its third edition. Most recently has co-edited the book David Bowie, Critical Perspectives. He's co-editor of Morrissey, Fandom Representation and Identities, and he's organized many conferences on subjects as the Smiths, Morrissey, Riot Girl, David Bowie, the Songs of Social Protest, etc. And he's also known for his sage videos, video lectures on such topics as the work of Stuart Hall, fandom, the ideology of media representations of poverty. So he, outside the academic circles as well, he has been very active in the media. Apart from this, he's a spare time DJ and writer of short fiction. But today, I think the academic side of his work will be foregrounded. So the title of his talk is Folk Devils and Blonde Angels, Media Framing of Those Blonde Roma Children. Welcome very much.
Thank you, Erki.
The floor is yours.
Thank you, Erki, and thank you for those kind remarks. It's really nice to be back in Finland. I have taught here and indeed presented research here over the years, and it's always lovely to be back to work with the team here. The team are always very welcoming and very kind and very friendly. I have had the honour, the pleasure of being an international advisor on the populism project here at Jyväskylä, and that has been a very productive time, a very interesting time, and it has resulted in lots of exchanges between Finland and Ireland, people moving back and forth, and the sharing of ideas and so on. So I'm particularly pleased to be back here again, and forgive me if I'm excited about the snow, because we don't get very much snow in Ireland, and it's a pleasure to see the snow falling today. I'm sure you're fed up of the snow. The work I'm going to present on today comes from a research project which is located within the Power, Discourse and Society Research Cluster at UL. And the team of people involved are Aileen Maron, Anne-Marie Joyce, James Carr, my colleague who is here today, Martin Power, Amanda Haynes, and also Michael Breen, who is here also in the audience. And Professor Breen and I will be talking tomorrow, looking at more quantitative, empirical data about beliefs around immigration and indeed populist discourses tomorrow in the conference. As I begin, I want to actually give you a very simple slide, which I was going to call Ireland 101, but for the case that I'm going to talk about today, I wanted you to be kind of aware of where I was talking about, and there will be a number of terms that I will talk about when I'm talking about the more technical aspects of the case. So the two events where there was effectively a state abduction of two Roma children in 2013. The first case happened in a town called Talla, which is in Dublin, which is in County Dublin. And the second case, a day later, took place in the Midlands, in the middle of Ireland, in a town called Athlone. I'll also, in the course of my paper, refer quite a bit to the Gardaí. And the Gardaí is simply the Gaelic word for police in Ireland. Some of the other key actors in this are the state health structure known in Ireland as the Health Services Executive, or HSE for short. There is also mention of the Ombudsman for Children, because there's quite a critical report over what happened to these Roma children, and particularly the role of the media and the relationship between the media and the police in Ireland, in terms of leaking confidential information and so on about this community, who are often the source of suspicion. And the particular piece of legislation that the case study refers to is the 1991 Childcare Act. So I suppose before I introduce the case, I just want to say something briefly in an overall way in terms of what we're doing in this bigger piece of research, and indeed then the specifics of what I'm going to talk about this afternoon. I suppose we're interested in looking in Limerick at what populist discourses look like. And in particular, we're interested in analysing political discourse, statements of politicians in the parliament and in local government. But we're particularly interested in the media's role in creating and generating a moral panic concerning the Roma and indeed other groups in Irish society. So our particular interest is focusing on the media's role and particularly also focusing on, you know, the way in which populist discourses are constructed and circulated. The theoretical underpinning of the work we're doing in this project is framing theory, and I'll talk quite a bit about framing and media frames this afternoon. I should say as well at the outset that, and I suppose I'm mindful, the last time I was here speaking about populism, it was Jim McGuigan who talked about the necessity to engage with not just traditional media forms such as print and broadcast media, but also to look at what's happening in the Twitter sphere and in other social media settings. So the data we have captured in the overall project includes social media content. The event I'm talking about today was the most tweeted about event in Ireland in 2013. This was the most spoken about event in Twitter. So we have captured broadcast content, print content that I'm going to focus on today, and content from social media also. So let me begin by just saying something about an international event that took place, which really became a trigger event for what unfolded in Ireland within a couple of days. On the 16th of October in 2013, police carried out a raid on a Roma camp in Pharsala in central Greece. They rescued Maria, a four-year-old child who was presumed to be the victim of child abduction. Blonde, with fair skin and green-blue eyes, it was believed that she couldn't be related to the Roma gypsies claiming to be her family. DNA tests revealed that the child was not a blood relative of her Roma parents, who were arrested on suspicion of child abduction. The child was subsequently removed from the camp and placed in the care of a local charity. Greek police appealed to the international community to help identify Maria. And what was interesting in the coverage of Greece was that the old myths of child abduction were quickly resurrected within media discourse, which drew upon this longer-standing trope about children being stolen. Children, it was said in this coverage, were bought and sold for begging or for claiming social welfare payments. Media commentators asked how many other children might be hidden in such camps, and references were made to high-profile missing children such as Madeleine McCann and Ben Needham. And it's interesting, even in the construction of that, a lot of the discourse referred to Madeleine McCann and to other white children from Western Europe who have gone missing or been abducted and so on. So while the Maria case was still dominating the global news cycle, the Irish police force, the Gardaí, invoked Section 12 of the Childcare Act to forcibly remove a seven-year-old blonde child from a Roma family living in Talla, County Dublin. Within 24 hours, Gardaí in Athlone, in the Irish Midlands, used the same legislation to remove a two-year-old blonde child from another Roma family. Both of these instances in Ireland arose out of emails sent to the police by members of the public, alerting them to the existence of blonde children living with Roma families. Both emails, for Dublin, Talla, and for Athlone, both emails referred specifically to the Maria case. The children were returned to their parents within 48 hours, once DNA tests revealed that they were, in fact, the biological children of the Roma couples in question. Before the children's return, however, details of both cases were leaked to the media, including private health information about one of the children, confidential information of the child's medical condition, resulting in news stories across the world as being the most tweeted about topic in Ireland that year. The decision to take two children into care and the public controversy which followed resulted in a decision by the Ombudsman for Children to launch an official inquiry. Her report acknowledges the influential role of the media in reporting of the Maria case. It also points, quite critically, to the leaking, as I said, of confidential information to journalists concerning the Roma children. So recognising the media's power in determining public discourse and beliefs, I take a closer look this afternoon at how the decision to take two Roma children into care was explained by the Irish print media. And as you'll see, the analysis finds that five distinct media frames dominated in the coverage. The first frame, and I'll talk about these in more detail in a few moments, the first and most dominant frame in the coverage justifies the actions of the police and the health services executive by portraying the case simply as an issue of child protection rather than one of racial stereotyping. The second frame suggests that the removal of the Roma children was a case of racial profiling. The third frame focuses on the actions of the health services executive and the police, portraying these state agencies as being too heavy-handed and being unaccountable. The fourth frame serves to question the media's involvement on the reporting of both cases and depicts their role as being irresponsible. And finally, and much less prominent in the coverage, the fifth frame examines the trauma experienced by the Roma families involved in both cases. So I'm going to begin my examination of these media framings of the Roma in Ireland by commenting briefly on the ways in which the Roma are routinely racialized and excluded in Ireland and indeed beyond. I will then plot a timeline, of events as they unfolded, and I will note the media's pivotal role in the unfolding moral panic and how it contributed significantly to the spread of populist discourses concerning the Roma. So, where Ireland is concerned, it is estimated that there are between 3,000 and 6,000 Roma people living in Ireland, manifesting as lives lived on the periphery of European societies. Roma communities, of course, experience structural discrimination in education, health, housing, and employment, as well as being the victims of hate crime and police harassment. Migration offers a potential means to escape such experiences. Fueled by populist discourses and practices that stigmatize Roma communities as being less than citizens, and despite being EU citizens, European Roma communities have been subjected to mass deportations from EU states on the basis that they are a threatening other, interested only in taking advantage of the system. EU-wide studies demonstrate that the aforementioned practices of exclusion are not the preserve of any one state. And I'm sure here you're quite familiar with many highly reported cases of such deportations. Irish research, similarly, demonstrates discrimination experienced amongst the Roma communities when accessing goods and services, employment, healthcare, social protection, and housing. Roma are routinely treated as a security risk by the police, subject to practices of ethnic profiling and related incidents of harassment. Instead of being offered protection by the police, Roma in Ireland are faced with a crime control model of justice, a fact made all the more alarming given the exposure to hate crime that the Roma experience. Reports on hate crime in Ireland, published by the European Network Against Racism, evidence racially aggravated assaults, verbal abuse, and damage to property directed towards the Roma. These are fueled by populist discourses propagated on conventional and social media platforms. So there's a well-documented case in Ireland of social media being used to literally round up members of the public and go and protest outside a Roma family's house in the city of Waterford in the southeast of the country. And again, much of these practices being fueled by people who are engaging in political opportunism. So it's evident that whether in experiences of discrimination or hate crime, Roma communities in Ireland and elsewhere continue to be stigmatized. They're constructed as a racial underclass, the labeling of which further embeds and legitimizes the social exclusion of Roma communities in Ireland and elsewhere. Now, I suppose what Roma have in common, in Ireland we have an ethnic minority that we refer to as travellers, the Irish traveller community. They are certainly quite similar in terms of the kinds of experiences that the Roma encounter, and it is almost entirely normalised in majority society for people to be racist towards this minority of people. I mentioned my colleague James Carr. James has done some very, very interesting work on the Muslim community in Ireland and the similar kinds of practices that emerge for Muslims in the Republic of Ireland. And you know, other groups like migrants who might be more visible, such as Nigerian immigrants to Ireland, again encounter similar experiences. Okay, so that's the sort of background context. The case itself is interesting. So a week or so after the Greek Maria case, a television journalist on the 20th of October called Paul Connolly, he received a message on his professional Facebook page which stated, "Hi Paul, today was on the news the blonde child found in Roma camp in Greece. There is also a little girl living in a Roma house in Tala, and she is blonde and blue eyes. Her name is, and her address is, I am from," and the person identifies where they are from, "myself, and it's a big problem there, missing kids, the Romas robbing them to get child benefit in Europe." So what happened immediately was that this journalist, now this particular journalist has a track record in terms of, you know, doing undercover journalism around Roma, begging, looking at people on welfare, looking at travellers, looking at other minority groups. So he's, you know, he's been involved in this kind of broadcast content before. He contacted the Gardaí, the Irish police, on the morning of the 21st of October. So the journalist tipped off the police. The children's ombudsman's report, a woman called Emily Logan at the time, detailed the key events surrounding the decision to take these two children into state care. Connolly's email received the attention of a Garda sergeant at 2 p.m., and the sergeant spent the next hour and a half carrying out preliminary inquiries. These included checking child protection records, speaking with a Garda colleague who knew the family, contacting the principal of the local school, contacting the Department of Social Protection, and contacting the HSE social work team. It emerged that the child was commonly known by a name that differed to official records. But there were no recorded concerns relating to the child, and the school principal had no concerns relating to the child or her family. Although the sergeant attempted to make contact with the author of the post on Paul Connolly's Facebook page, this hadn't happened prior to the decision being taken to progress the investigation further by calling directly to the child's house without the aid of an interpreter. Upon doing so, the Gardaí decided to invoke legislation designed for the protection of children in urgent, compelling, and thus rare circumstances in order to remove the child from her family and place her in the care of social workers without the prior agreement of a district court judge. In the subsequent inquiry, the sergeant cited the following reasons for making this decision. And these are interesting. The child didn't resemble her family. The hospital at which she was born was unable to immediately find a record of her birth. Whilst her mother produced a social security number, she didn't have a birth cert or recent passport available. A consultant doctor, contacted by telephone by the police, advised that it was highly unusual for a blonde and blue-eyed child to have two parents of dark hair and eyes. The child went by a different name to her official name. Extended family members had criminal records and resided outside the state, and therefore it was concluded that the family were deemed to be a flight risk. The following morning, news of the story broke, and a large number of journalists began to arrive at the home of the Roma family. Citing police sources, minute details of the events as they unfolded at the child's house were revealed. These included who was in the house at the time the police arrived, the child's appearance, her place and date of birth, the opinion of the consultant doctor previously contacted by phone. Then, having spent two nights with a foster family in quite a distraught state, the child was returned to her parents when DNA testing revealed that she was, in fact, their biological daughter. The special inquiry report also gives us evidence about the key events which led up to the removal of a second Roma child. So the next day, on the morning of the 21st of October, Gardaí, in the middle of Ireland, in Athlone, received an email which had been sent to the Missing Persons Bureau from a member of the public with a subject heading, Suspected Child Abduction. The author of the email had been at a festival that summer where her daughters had had their hair braided at a stall run by a Roma family with a baby boy. So the email said, while my children were getting their braids in, I preoccupied myself with the little baby. He had very blonde hair and the bluest eyes, and his complexion was also fair. Apart from the baby, all the others were completely dark in complexion, eyes and hair. The recent news about the little Maria who was found made me realise that I should have reported it. Because of the subject heading of the email, the police deemed it necessary to treat the case as potentially high risk and requiring urgent action. Having checked police records for any concern relating to the child and having found none, the decision was made to visit the child's home address. Once there, the child was found to indeed be blonde, with blue eyes and a pale complexion. The child's birth certificate didn't include the father's name. A local policeman who knew of the family hadn't known of the child, and so the family were asked to attend the police station. An interpreter wasn't sought at any time. Although the local hospital confirmed the birth of the child, it was finally decided to invoke Section 12 of the Child Care Act 1991 in order to remove the child from his family and place him in the care of a foster family. And again, the reasons cited by police included the child matched the description given in the email from the member of the public who was concerned. A local Garda policeman had knowledge of the family but had never seen the child before. The family were deemed to be transient and thus were a flight risk. The following morning, it was ascertained from medical records that the child was an albino, and this accounted for his fair hair, eyes, and complexion. He was returned to his parents, but crucially, not before the story was leaked again to the media. And there was a media presence outside of the family's home when they returned, having collected him from the social worker. And I mentioned earlier about the event being the most tweeted about event in Ireland that year. And this is perhaps the most notorious tweet where somebody, a well-known athlete, tweeted, unbelievably dirty scumbags, they should be shipped out. And this became, now the person in question has since apologised and withdrawn the tweet and so on, but you know, it fueled a whole debate on Twitter about the events as they were happening. So the parallels in the media coverage with Greece were very, very prominent, and they really dominate in the headlines that we see when we come to look at how the media portrayed the story. So when we come to look at how the print media, in the case of what I'm going to talk about this afternoon, how it framed the events and how it reported on the events, we see five key kinds of framing taking place in terms of how the story is packaged and how the story is explained, how it's narrated, and the kinds of discourses being used. So it's first and foremost portrayed in the print media and indeed in the broadcast media as being, this is about child protection, this is not about racism, this is not about the Roma, this is just circumstantial that the family are happen to be members of the Roma community. It then shifts to a lesser degree to focus on the question or not of whether this involves racial profiling. And I suppose what is interesting, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later on, what is interesting is that The media do the initial framing of this. They clearly set the agenda in terms of public debate and discourse. And then when the story comes unstuck and the children are found to be the biologically, biological children of the families involved, suddenly the discourse shifts, and now the police are being blamed and social workers are being blamed and the state are being blamed. And there's some reflection on irresponsible media reporting and on the ordeal of the Roma families, but it's quite an interesting act of magic almost, or conjury by the media, that they set the agenda, they shape the public discourse, they engage in the initial agenda setting, they are the ones who use language in a particular way, and then quite quickly, literally within days, they absolve themselves of any responsibility in terms of how they have created a moral panic, how they have contributed to this, how they have spread particular discourses, and suddenly now the story becomes about other actors, and as if the media are somehow absolutely neutral and divorced from these events. So the first frame, and I'll just say something about each of the frames. The first frame is focused on the issue of child protection. And this frame was evident across tabloid and broadsheet media that we looked at. And what is interesting is the sources within these articles is quite interesting, in that the frame where we're hearing this issue of that this is about child protection, the frame relies very heavily on government sources to journalists in explaining what is happening, and also to a lesser extent through the voice of journalists themselves. According to both Entman and Rees, media frames are, of course, organizing principles which serve to structure information through the processes of selection and salience. This frame, an issue of child protection, is structured on the basis of what Cohen would call a moral panic that is anchored mainly on the Greek case, but also on previous high-profile child abductions and cases of Irish child abuse. These reasoning devices combine to produce a clear and consistent interpretative package that invoked a heightened sense of risk and focus attention onto the idea that it is always better to be safe than sorry when dealing with matters concerning children. This frame functions like an emphasis frame by focusing attention onto a particular subset of potentially relevant considerations. For example, on October 23rd, 7 of the 13 articles published on that day highlighted the supposed similarities between the circumstances surrounding Maria and the events concerning a Roma family in Talla, County Dublin. The articles, interestingly, othered the Roma families in question on the basis that the blonde-haired and blue-eyed children looked physically different from their dark parents and siblings. And this is the language that was being used in the coverage. In addition, 8 of the 13 articles we looked at questioned their legitimacy by expressing doubts over the authenticity of their birth certificates, their medical records, and their passports, thus increasing suspicion and placing the burden of proof onto the Roma families in question. So this in turn justified and normalised the actions of the police and the state health authorities. Comparisons were also made with the high-profile abduction of Madeleine McCann in 4 of the articles we looked at. One of these articles, an editorial opinion piece written by a columnist from the Irish Independent, suggested that the Greek case and the Talla case would cause people to re-evaluate what happened to Madeleine McCann, noting towards the end of the article that there had in the past been, quote, reported sightings of Madeleine with a tall and swarthy man. So, there is an attempt in the first frame to focus on issues of child protection and to justify, you know, why the police did what they did. And it's also interesting to see that there's very significant source bias in terms of how the stories are written, the kinds of sources that are used, largely government sources, sources by coming from the Garda, the police press office, and so on. And so you were not in the first blush, first wave of the story, hearing from groups who will be working with the Roma community in Ireland, the Roma themselves. So it's very much a state perspective on this minority group, and the actions of the police in the first wave of the coverage are very much absolved as being, you know, that they're kind of damned if they do, they're damned if they don't. They were basically doing the right thing by the children. So when the issues are investigated, when the children are returned to their families, it's quite clear from the evidence of the Ombudsman for Children that there was absolutely no evidence at the centre of either of these cases that the children were in any immediate danger. There were no issues with child protection on record relating to the children. And, you know, so the focus is very much on the government constructing these two cases as issues of child protection. A second frame evident in the content emphasises the idea of racial profiling. And this is interesting because it begins to try and counter the initial kind of agenda setting that the media engaged in. The second frame identified constructs the incidents in both Talla and Athlone as cases of racial profiling. Characteristics of this frame featured in 29 of the articles that we looked at. Of these, 8 appeared in the Irish Independent, 6 in the Irish Times, 7 in the Irish Examiner, 5 in the Irish Daily Mail, and 3 in the Irish Daily Mirror. And they begin to include the perspectives of groups like Pavi Point, who work on behalf of travellers, gypsies, and Roma, and so on, the Roma Support Group, and the Immigrant Council of Ireland, as well as members of the political opposition. And again, here, the use of sources is interesting in terms of how the stories which use the racial profiling frame are constructed. We see this as being an example of a thematic frame. And the frame is somewhat comparable, we think, to Iyengar's conceptualization of a thematic frame in that it places the incidents in Talla and Athlone into a wider contextual perspective. In contrast, episodic frames examine issues of single instances. The degree to which content is framed either thematically or episodically can have an impact on how the reader attributes responsibility to an issue. With thematic frames, this responsibility is likely to be attributed to systemic causes, whereas episodic frames will focus on the individual. This frame contained 4 articles which took an historical look at the Roma community and highlighted the racism and poverty experienced by both the international Roma community and those living in Ireland. Attempts were also made in a small number of articles to deconstruct some of the common myths and stereotypes commonly attributed to the Roma, such as being labelled as child snatchers. So there is a counter-narrative also being circulated within a number of days of the story unfolding. So what is interesting is that when the media cover this, and they really go at this, to use a kind of colloquial phrase, hell for leather. I mean, they go about this story in a really big, heavy-handed way in the first couple of days, and they very much set the agenda in terms of how people are beginning to discuss and debate and understand what is happening. Very quickly, when it comes to light that, in fact, mistakes have been made and there are questions to be asked about the police and about social workers and their involvement in what happened, suddenly the focus then shifts in media coverage to blame, to focus on the police as being heavy-handed, incompetent, and unaccountable. So this frame, the third frame, portrays the police and health workers as being heavy-handed in their approach. They're accused of being incompetent and unaccountable. Words and phrases such as shambolic, monstrous invasion, omni-shambles were used to describe the actions of both the health workers and the police in both cases. And again, this is quite interesting that the sources used are not official sources, they're not government sources. The biggest source of opinion and perspective on what had unfolded came from newspaper columnists and journalists themselves. So we see the media relying on journalists as experts, and it is now journalists who are blaming others for what happened and their incompetence and so on. So it's interesting that that is the case. And so there's a focus then, as the story shifts, on irresponsible media reporting. Again, there is some coverage of this, but numerically, the stories are fewer than those ones that would have focused on issues of child protection. So a number of articles, to varying degrees, referenced the role of the media in reporting on these cases. Of these articles, 11 were news reports, 5 were opinion pieces. In 9 of these articles, criticisms of the media's reporting of the cases and the close relationship between the police and the media featured only through the voice of a source. Of these sources, 5 statements were made by politicians, 2 were made by Paddy Point, and 1 was made by representatives of the European Rights Group, the Roma Support Group, and the Integration Centre. And a very interesting twist, you know, happens in the coverage where you have an independent socialist TD blaming the police for what happened, and indeed criticising their close relationship with journalists in terms of feeding journalistic reporting and misrepresentation of the issues. Elements in the Gardaí, in the police, are feeding their pet poodles in the media, as the politician hit out at a media frenzy and evidence of irresponsible journalism. So, what is interesting is that we see some reflection, but not a huge amount, we see some reflection by print media journalists on the events as they unfolded that week, in those few days. So some print media professionals engaged critically and reflexively with the media's role in these cases. In the main, the reportage across time, the time period examined as part of our analysis, was firmly focused to a much greater extent on the actions of the state. This pattern subsequently moved attention away from the role of the media in reporting both the incidents in Talla and in Athlone, and in general in constructing the Roma in Ireland as the racialised other. And the issue of the close relationship, the sort of symbiotic relationship between people working in the mainstream mass media in Ireland and their access to confidential information, their access to police sources and so on, is really critical in terms of understanding this particular case. So the issue of this relationship was criticised by the Children's Ombudsman, Emily Logan, also by the independent socialist TD, Claire Daly, and both criticised the close relationship between the police and the media, particularly in relation to the leaking of confidential information concerning the families involved. The report also notes the influence of the Greek case on reporting in Ireland of the incidents in Talla and Athlone, namely the mistaken view that the Roma community does not include individuals with fair hair and features, combined with an immediately heightened suspicion that the presence of such children with Roma families would be readily explained by abduction. So there is then a final fifth frame which focuses on the ordeal of the Roma family. But again, numerically, this is the smallest number of articles in the data that we gathered. Some of it's quite sympathetic to the families themselves. They follow a human interest frame and so on, but you know, really they come at the very tail end of the piece when the agenda has been set, when public debate has been set in a particular way. And it's interesting that the very same publications, and again I think this is kind of refers to what I'm talking about when I talk about the media being able to engage in a kind of conjury, a kind of act of magic, that the very publications that 6 days earlier were demonizing the Roma, who were jumping to conclusions. Like one of the broadcast stations, you know, talked about the child taken away from the people that she believed to be her family. So they had concluded before any DNA testing were done that these children had been abducted, the families were guilty of state abduction and so on. And the very same media outlets within 6 or 7 days are now writing, numerically much smaller, but they're writing human interest stories, really soft stories about the awful impact these events have had on these children's lives. So, in October 2013, sensationalist and racist media discourses concerning the plight of the blonde angel Maria gave rise to yet another moral panic concerning the Roma. Media coverage of the Greek case rehearsed previously circulated tropes and myths about alleged child stealing and Roma criminality more generally. The media-generated moral panic, that's exactly what it was, certainly in the Irish case and indeed in Greece, the media-generated moral panic which ensued after the discovery of Maria was clearly influential in the actions of those who reported the sightings of blonde Roma children to an Irish journalist and to the Irish police. This paper holds that the media's reporting of the Greek case, replete as it was with ethnic stereotypes, racism and suspicion, served as a trigger for the subsequent actions of the Irish authorities. It raises some important questions, we think, concerning the ways in which the Irish print media reported on these events. The first concerns reporting practices. The Children's Ombudsman, as I've mentioned, her report into these events notes how personal confidential information was leaked to and used by some of the media. Similarly, respect for the right to privacy in what was obviously a very sensitive matter was also ignored. The case demonstrates not only source bias, but also a relationship between sections of the media and state authorities, which appears to be far too close. The framing of the Greek and Irish Roma cases took place in a media setting, first and foremost. And of course, media frames are never neutral. They represent the social world in ways that are partial, biased, ideological, and particular. So this paper points to the ways in which the media managed to create the illusion that they are objectively reporting on things as they happen. This critical analysis of the media frames shows how a moral panic was generated through an initial emphasis on child protection and by the repeated suggestion of there being parallels between the Irish and Greek cases. And while the media discourses examined do allow for some consideration of whether or not racial profiling had taken place, the focus in the coverage quickly moved to blame the state for being too hasty to act. In that context, and with some notable exceptions, the lack of reflexivity on the media's own part as to their role as the primary definer of these events is quite striking, as is their ability to circulate uncritically discourses, and particularly populist discourses, concerning the Roma. So we can see how the Roma are, in this coverage, yet again, racialized as a suspect community. Clearly the media have a very significant role in setting the agenda, setting the initial agenda, and indeed informing a larger moral panic, drawing upon populist discourses. I've raised also the issue of source bias, particularly in the early days of the reporting of the story, and in particular the question of the relationship between the mainstream media and the police. And we would argue that there is in fact a tokenistic balance in the coverage, and what we see overall is the maintenance, the normalization of racialized discourses. What is also striking is the lack of reflexivity about these issues. And we see, in one sense, I think this story will be repeated. The same kinds of tropes, the same kinds of language will be used, not just in Ireland, but will occur and recur elsewhere over and over again. And just, I suppose, to say that the next phase of the research that we're working on is going to now look at the case within social media and indeed broadcast media as well. Thank you. Thank you, Erky.
It was a very interesting case of
yes.
Populist discourse, racially motivated populist discourse. Ah, okay.
And I wonder, I mean, have you, did you try to kind of broadcast or send the results of your analysis to the media? As you mentioned, that there was a patent lack of self-reflexivity. So you did this very reflectively. So has there been any kind of...
In short, we haven't. We will. Now, I know from experience that research that I did a long, long time ago with one of my colleagues, Amanda Haynes, in Limerick, and back in 2000, 2001, and it was about, at that stage, it was about how Irish print and broadcast media more generally portray poverty and social exclusion. And there were clearly many people in the media who were open to the idea, and many of them, indeed, when we spoke to them, talked about the fact that their lives as journalists and as media professionals didn't allow for much time for reflection on these issues. They were willing, kind of in the short term, to engage in debate about these issues, but also these were in a minority, and I think also what has happened within the world of journalism more generally is I think that because the media industry has been rationalized, greater focus on marketization, I think the pressures that particularly younger journalists are under, they're doing much more work. There's a lot of more pressures in terms of feeding various platforms, in terms of content and so on. So I suppose, in one sense, what I'm saying is that I'm even more pessimistic now about their ability to engage in this kind of reflexive activity.
Another question before everybody else comes in. I was wondering, because in populist discourse in general, often particular issues of this kind, they are connected or articulated with some other discourses, so it's becomes a kind of avalanche, creating a very large kind of internal frontier in some larger terms even.
Yes.
So I was wondering if this could be connected with, for example, national or nationalist issues, this kind of exclusion of the Roma, and that could be kind of become more politically intense then.
Yeah.
And gathering entirely other issues under the same.
Sure.
Same big thing.
Politically, Ireland is unusual in that, certainly within the mainstream political parties, like we have documented lots of examples of the kinds of comments, the kinds of discourses that established politicians would make about immigrants and so on. Ireland is unusual in that there are a number, like literally maybe two or three, really, really, really tiny right-wing political groups. They have no representation. They're not in the parliament. They're not on local government structures or anything like that. They're sometimes could be made up of five or six people, so they're tiny. Now, they can be quite vocal sometimes in some media settings, but they have no political power. And while there are instances of established politicians engaging in opportunism about Roma or travellers or gypsies or poor people more generally or immigrants more generally, it is rare enough. So it is different, I think, to what has been happening here in terms of the True Finns and the larger mobilisation of issues around populist discourses.
Okay. Any comments, questions?
Did you track kind of the movement of these frames across the Irish national media, and was there a clear kind of agenda-setting leader, a news organization that... Okay.
Yes. Yeah. I mentioned the journalist Paul Connolly. Paul Connolly worked until recently for a commercial television station called TV3. So that television network would have... form in terms of having these programs about people on welfare, trailer trash, those sort of things. They were very much to the fore in terms of the story, but also the state broadcaster, which is bound, and in fact both broadcasters, and broadcasters are interesting, I'll just say this more generally, that there are very strict rules about balance and supposed objectivity and reporting and so on in Ireland. but I think they weren't observed, and there were issues about that. So yes, the two broadcast channels were quite significant. Social media was very significant as well. But it was, this story was literally everywhere, across.
And how is that news organization kind of culturally marked in the national press in Ireland? Are they like a, is it a tabloid, or is it a working class, or more aspirational middle class readership or viewership? Just curious how this relates with the kind of racial politics of their frames.
Yeah, where the print is concerned, I mean, we included all of the broadsheets and all of the tabloids on sale in the Republic of Ireland, okay? And there are some discernible differences between, let's say, the paper of record, the Irish Times, and how it would reflect on the issue, and the class basis of its readership and so on, and let's say something like the Irish Independent, which is ironically is both sold as a tabloid and a broadsheet. The same content is sold in two different formats, and that would be more populist. And you know, tabloids are obviously tabloids. Broadcast media, RTE, is the public service broadcaster and would be seen as, you know, the broadcaster of record and has a public service remit and, you know, strong rules in terms of fairness and balance and so on. A very good tradition in terms of critical current affairs reporting. TV3 less so, seen much more as commercially driven. News bulletins are shorter than the state broadcaster and so on, you know, so less of a focus on news. And what was interesting was, you know, TV3 are interesting because, you know, their journalist, Paul Connolly, was the person who was tipped off. Then he was brought in as the expert to comment on the event itself. So it's kind of the self-perpetuating story. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
I think he was first.
Okay. Don't fight.
Thank you very much for your talk. I remember the Greek case quite well, and I remember that some of the media also found the opportunity like to identify the propaganda, this racist propaganda,
yes,
against the Roma community. I mean, they found a step. And I remember even they were talking about this benefit industry, according to which a Roma family somehow rob or abduct children in order, you know, to gain benefits, which is, of course, was all lie. I mean, this thing didn't. I think that this little Maria was not even abducted. She was adopted.
Yes, there was an arrangement or something.
So I was just wondering whether anything similar happened in this Irish case.
Not so much in this case, right? Not in the specific case that week, but more generally in the way in which Roma are reported in the media in Ireland. They would refer to, like, begging is a big issue, recurring issue. Social welfare fraud, and so on. They are issues. Criminality. The case I mentioned about people being encouraged to go to protest at somebody's house. So they are there as well, yeah. They are very much so, yeah. Yeah. It's kind of assumed, you know, this is what they're at, yeah. Yeah.
Thanks, Owen. It seems to me that when you challenge media people or the commentariat after an episode like this, the kind of response you get is, well, we might have got it wrong this time, but the Roma are thieves and they are engaged in abduction and they're welfare fraudsters and so on. That there's this constant self-justification that no matter how much evidence you produce, it's never enough to convince those who are utterly prejudiced or blind.
Yes, yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I'm not sure what I can say to that. That's absolutely true. And I mentioned Irish travellers, the Nigerian community in particular are also, you know, treated in a heavily suspicious way in Ireland. And you know, these kinds of beliefs are taken as a given, and they're routinely disseminated in the media, and taken for granted.
Uh, Thank you for an interesting presentation.
Thank you.
So my question has to do with the context of this kind of representations, like the economic crisis context, and whether such kinds of stories that create moral panics, or stories that entail ethnic and class biases and prejudices and so on. Do you see whether there is an increase in these kind of stories within the economic crisis kind of temporal kind of in Greece, for example? There's more of these kind of stories within the last 6 or 7 years, also about prostitutes, about public health issues, about obviously all kinds of welfare scoundrels and so on. So yeah.
Yes, in the other work we've done, where we've looked at the kinds of comments and the kinds of discourses that politicians engage in about the economy, and we've looked at both right-wing and left-wing parties, social democratic parties and centre-right parties in Ireland, and we've looked at the kinds of things they've said about immigrants. And there is this almost sense of that when Ireland was a boom country, when we had this Celtic Tiger and we were this big, fantastic economy, that people were welcome, but now go away. You are no longer needed, or come back in 20 years' time when the economy has improved again. So we certainly saw an increase when the global economic crisis began, 2008, 2009, the particular issues in Ireland with the IMF and Troika and so on. Yes, there is an increase in really outlandish statements that politicians would make about particular groups of people. So, for example, in Limerick City, which is in the southwest of the country where I am from and my colleagues are from, we had the largest Dell computers plant in the world, and it was manufacturing Dell computers there. So what happened typically, they got some money from the European Union to move the company to Poland, and then after that they moved from Poland to China, to the Far East or whatever, and so there were lots of people being made unemployed, and two very prominent politicians in the city, one was the mayor, said, yeah, kind of more or less, what have the Poles ever done for us? It's time you go. They were being offered a Ryanair ticket to leave the country, maybe a month's social welfare, and then get out. We no longer need. So, immigrants were purely economic migrants and there to serve the labour market, and then no other purpose, just go, so you have an intensification of that, yeah, certainly.
Thank you. You mentioned that there was quite some social interest in these cases because there were the protests in front of front of the houses. But this takes me to my question, because if there was social interest in these issues, then why were they not reflected in the political rhetoric as well? Because you mentioned there are only two or three smaller right-wing populist parties. Mm-hmm. Why was this not exploited by the political system, given the fact that one of the practices of populist parties is scapegoating? Why was this not used for that? Or what were the reactions of the political system?
The
mainstream parties.
Well, okay, so this happened in a very short period of time. So initially, the politicians, the prime minister and others, in the first couple of days, straight away talked about, well, this is about child protection. This has nothing to do with racism, right? And then within 48 hours, the police were being blamed and the state authorities were being blamed. So they then did what politicians do, and they were saying, well, we will investigate this and we will see and so on. So it didn't become a big issue. There were comments about it, but it didn't become this big live issue in terms of mainstream politics. That's not to say, and I wouldn't like to create the impression that there aren't outrageous things said by politicians about minority groups. There are plenty of them, and well documented as well. Yeah, but there isn't that same kind of set of practices in Ireland. Irish politics, in many respects, operates very differently. it's much more driven by, we have this proportional representation, single transferable vote system. So let's say each constituency, each city might have 5 members of parliament, and it is very much driven by local issues. And Irish, the majority of what happens in mainstream Irish politics operates and is determined by a sort of a patronage system. So politicians are elected really for doing favours for you. So in many respects, they don't spend their time making big statements. They are looking for health insurance for you, or a house, or a place in a school, or whatever, you know, and that's what gets them elected. Yes, yeah, absolutely. Very, very different, yeah. And it's, and what is interesting, I'll just say this quickly, what is interesting, we've just had a general election, which is inconclusive, and I was looking very carefully at where, when votes are transferred. So if you vote for this candidate, then you transfer for that candidate, and in many respects, there's no logic, there's no ideological logic about saying, well, he has voted for a right-wing politician, but also now he's transferred his vote to somebody who's in the centre or somebody who's further left. So it's more to do with the impression, the illusion that this man or woman is good for Yvlaskala or for Limerick, and he has bought a hospital or a school or whatever. You know, it's very different, yeah? But there have been, you know, there have been things said as well. Thank God.
Thanks. Thanks, Owen.
Hi, how are you?
This was really interesting, and also your discussion about the patronage system and how politics can be different. It's quite similar to, for instance, Hungary. Mm-hmm. So my first question, I have a couple of big questions for you, but I know that you can answer them.
That's
so
right.
So first one is about like the transnational phenomenon of racism of this sort, especially in regards to Roma population.
Yeah.
Have you looked at that at all? And so is it similar in Ireland? That does it travel? As you said, it kind of travels, but how does it travel? And does it take the same forms, perhaps?
I think my sense is that it does travel. Yeah, the same things are replicated. And even, you know, I know when I've looked more generally at work around migration more generally, immigration, the kinds of metaphors that are used, the idea of the flood, the tide, the influx, even the way the issues in the last year are being discussed, the refugee problem. It's a humanitarian problem. It's an issue about, you know, it's a humanitarian crisis, but it's always shifting about being the asylum problem or the refugee problem. So I think these things are transnational and they are replicated and they do travel.
And then the next question is about the relationship between populism and racism.
Yes.
I mean, these are two distinct things, but do they all also like use each other or carry each other? Or how would you somehow, because your work encapsulates both of them.
It does, yeah, and I think they do. I think they have this relationship where they carry each other. It's interesting, in Ireland, the term populist in Ireland is used in quite a different way, because we've been doing lots of work on there's a movement against this new taxation on water in Ireland, and it is largely a sort of coalition of left-wing groups, Sinn Féin, Socialist Party, Communist Party, and so on, Socialist Workers' Party, and the establishment, centre-right political parties, all the time they talk about they talk about it being a sinister movement, sinister fringe, criminal, and so on. But they talk about the left being populist. Sinn Féin, who are becoming more prominent, nationalist party of the left, they're routinely dismissed as populist in Ireland. So it's often used in Irish context. It's often used in the sense of identifying left-wing groups who are critical of the system. In terms of populist discourses and racism, I think they have this. I think they are two sides of the same coin. I think they carry that. They allow that to happen.
And my final question.
Three questions.
3 points. Populist culture.
Yes.
Do you think this generation of the dichotomy is something like populist culture, or is it like the somehow also like the carnivalization of this racism? Could it be something that, because we've been discussing this for 3 years, that's why I have three questions. Yeah. Sorry. So what do you think about that?
I don't know. I mean, I use the term, I went back to a very, if you like, old concept within old now, right? Because I'm getting old, but old in sociological terms. You know, I see this first and foremost as being a moral panic. I think that's what's happening. I think it's, and this is what we see. We see the media whipping up a frenzy about a group who are in minority, who don't have access in terms of giving their side of the story, their version of events. We see racialized discourses being routinely used. And I'm just looking here as an example of a broadsheet prior to this where the Roma are described in a mainstream newspaper in Ireland as being a parasitic, ethnic underclass, the criminal Roma, right? And again, I suppose it's important to stress that these things, these kinds of descriptions, these discourses, they happen routinely and are quite normalized. And that's a huge issue. You know, the indigenous ethnic minority in Ireland, the Travellers, I would suggest that a majority, a very significant majority of people think that it's perfectly acceptable to be racist and hostile towards this group of people. It's just widespread. And the Roma are the kind of new wave of this, you know. So, yeah, I see it in more traditional terms rather than how you've described it. Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks, Owen.
James.
I guess just as well, it's something that Mecca touched on there in terms of populism within the Irish context. The establishment parties, if you want to call them the establishment parties up to now, have in many ways filled the space that populist parties speak to. So we see citizenship redrawn in Ireland, just over 10, 12 years ago now, redrawn along these notions of bloodlines as opposed to place of birth or birthright citizenship. We have an asylum system which is punitive, to say the least, in the Irish context. People aren't allowed to work. For all the world, it's a prison system for people who are seeking asylum. We have the continued denial of the ethnicity or ethnic status to members of the traveller community as well. And on top of that, in the context of the Waterford protests about Roma, only one establishment politician really spoke out about that. And now I would be critical of him, very critical of him, but he spoke out against the protests. He's a junior minister, and it was notable that he was the only voice of government that spoke out against this. And also within government itself, we have ministers coming up with quite clearly racist statements over the course of the year, over the years. They might get punished, they might be, you know, lose their post for a while, but within a year or so they're back in government or back in the establishment, if you will. So the spaces, we see groups like Pegida and so forth trying to form in the Irish context, but a lot of the wind for their sails has already been taken by the establishment parties in themselves.
Yeah, we had to add to what James said there, there was a very interesting example of where I mentioned we had a politician who, the famous phrase was, I would rather be called a racist than a traitor, right, is the phrase he used and talked about this. And then all of the other politicians were asked in a vox pop, you know, in a newspaper, you know, do you agree or disagree with what this politician has said? And one of really the most successful politician in the locality that I'm talking about, but his answer was fantastic in the sense he said, well, on the one hand, this, and on the other hand, that. So you could see he has a point, but maybe he shouldn't have said it. So he was kind of playing to two different constituencies in the one paragraph. So he was playing to the populist version of things and to the more critical version of things as well in the statement he made. So, yeah, you're quite right in terms of how that operates.
That could be the typically invasive populist.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, thank you again for a very inspiring talk.
Thank you.
What is your experience or your view on the difference or expected difference between oral reporting and written reporting on migration or on specific cases, as we've heard from you? So is there a difference in strategy? So kind of if we remember also hiding between hiding, if you have a text, maybe you don't see the real person, maybe who is judging someone. So, yeah, what is your experience with that?
From the broadcast media we've looked at, we would equally be critical of much of the coverage, you know, and live reporting even of the events outside the children's homes and the kinds of assumptions that are routinely used by journalists in reporting on the events. So it is problematic also. That's the next phase of what we're doing in terms of in a more systematic way. But in terms of our, you know, being familiar with the data, yeah, I think there are. Okay, so it's different because particularly in a current affairs context, if you have more than one opinion, you can have debate and discussion and so on. So it's different than obviously a written text. But certainly the news reporting that we looked at at this time. We think that it is quite problematic also.
Thank you.
In the midst of the moral panic, was there any kind of counter narratives? Because part of your critique is this lack of reflexivity, but yes. Were there examples of journalists that were offering counter-narratives or more critical interpretations of the event? That's my first question. And the second one is about this bigger question about racism and populism, and whether you're saying that populism is inherently a kind of vehicle for white nationalist appeals, or given the history of Irish communities in the United States or in the UK being themselves the victims of ethnic scapegoating, is there a possibility of populism being used as a tool of anti-racism, or that could have been mobilized in counter-narratives that could have been crafted in this example?
Yeah, there is some counter-narrative from activist groups and indeed from some journalists, but they're in a minority. And in terms of the sequence of the story, it occurs later in terms of, you know, the agenda is set and then it occurs. The issue of populism and racism, and more particularly then the Irish experience, is interesting because certainly when we've looked more generally, Michael Breen, who's at the end here, he and I have looked with another colleague at public beliefs about immigrants, and in the media and elsewhere, and out there, you know, in terms of just public debate, there is a great deal of amnesia in Ireland now about the immigrant experience of Irish people when they went to the United States. Right, so a very famous book that I often send students off to read, and the book is called "How the Irish Became White." Right, so like if you look at our initial experiences in the United States. Before, you know, changes there, and likewise in the United Kingdom. I mean, until relatively recently, you know, Ireland wasn't always Riverdance, U2, and trendy Irish pubs. Until the early 1980s, we were a suspect community. We were terrorists, we were criminal, we were welfare scroungers, we were... my father was a migrant, and he knocked on the door of a house in London, in the 1950s, and the woman said, in all sort of innocence and honesty, well, I don't take Irish people or blacks, but there is a woman down the road who does. So, racism where the Irish were concerned was entirely normalized. And it's interesting in Ireland now, when people talk about new migrants, when they talk about the new Irish, when they talk about people who have come to Ireland, they will set this up in opposition to this idea of Irish people, when we went to the United States, we worked, or when we went to the UK, we worked, and we were respectable, and so on. And you have this mad scenario, today is St. Patrick's Day, and you have this mad scenario that our Irish Prime Minister, yesterday or the day before, met Barack Obama, and the usual thing every year on the 16th or 17th is that our Prime Minister travels to the United States and lobbies on behalf of the illegal Irish in the United States. And yet, as James said, we have this situation in Ireland where people are being incarcerated as asylum seekers. They're given €19.10 a week. They're living in totally inappropriate conditions. So there's a very interesting, I think, thing going on in terms of how we have reinvented our own immigrant experience as being entirely positive, and that we're not in any way like these scroungers who have come to Ireland. So I'm kind of less convinced that it can be used. I mean, ideally it should be used as a way of, I would frame it like that in terms of the parallels between the experience of being a member of a suspect community, being Irish, being immigrant Irish, and the issues there. I think, you know, there's obviously huge room for scope in terms of explaining issues around ethnicity and so on, but I'm pessimistic as to whether that will happen or not. I think they're getting tired now, Erky. They're sick of listening to me. I should say, given my media training from a million years ago, that, and I wouldn't normally do this, what I was talking about today is contained in a new book out next month, but I'm mentioning it because the book is coming out. I'm very proud of it, and my colleagues, James and Michael, are here as well. But it also has a nice connection with my colleagues here in Yevlaskala. So Tuija and Tuuli have a really lovely chapter in this book, Public and Political Discourses of Migration, on Islam Night. I worked with them on the chapter. Lovely piece of writing. And so you can find more on the Roma and what I was talking about today there, but also some very interesting work from my colleagues here in Yevlaskala. Thank you.
And apropos your connection
with
UAP, I apologize,
so for
very obvious that
you're
indeed part of the
advisory. Indeed. No. Proud to be doing that, yes.
Must be acknowledged. Yes. Okay, that's it. Thank you, Owen. Thank you, everybody.